Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, author Stephen C. Bowie talks about Concerto for Cootie, The Life and Times of Cootie Williams. This biography about a legendary trumpeter in the Duke Ellington Big Band was published by the University of Mississippi Press in October 2025. Stephen Bowie was interviewed by fellow biographer and Bio member Kevin Magruder.
And to start out, Stephen, in the introduction, the very first page, you talk about how this book was 14 years in the making, and you began it when you were working at Northrop Grumman. Can you talk about that journey and how you came to be interested in a biography of Cootie Williams?
The idea for the book wasn't even mine. I had a dream back in 2010 that I was at a book stand off a busy street. And as I was grazing through the books, I happened to look over to the side and I saw Cootie Williams standing there looking at a book. And I thought this was rather unusual. So I went up to him and I asked him what he was reading. And he said it was a biography of him. And I said, oh, who wrote it? And he said, you did. And so I thought, The next morning I woke up and I remember the dream, which in itself is kind of unusual because I don't normally remember my dreams. And searching my memory, I couldn't recall that somebody had written a book about him. And after a quick search on the internet, I found out that was true. So I figured maybe this was a commission that I needed to listen to, and I decided to write the book. One of the things that also makes this unusual is that I'm an engineer by background. I didn't have an English degree or anything like that. So this is the first book I've written. It got published, and now I'm at the ripe old age of 66. So there's always a good time to start a new project.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Cootie Williams was a jazz trumpeter, and there's something in your background that planted the seeds for even that dream. Do you have a musical background? You're a jazz aficionado. What was that connection that you think planted that?
Well, I'm a huge jazz fan. Since the age of 10, I discovered jazz. And I fortunately realized that the life they live is not proportional to the merit of the music they produce. So I figured, I don't want to be a starving artist. So that, again, is why I went into engineering. But I've continued to play. I play saxophone, clarinet, and it's a better hobby than a profession.
Okay.
And one of my absolute favorites is Duke Ellington. And of course, Cootie Williams was one of the stars of Duke Ellington's orchestra.
Yeah. I got interested in Duke Ellington when I was in high school, and I'm 68. And my parents had his Blue Light album, which has Reminiscing in Tempo, and can't remember the other songs that I have now. And I knew of Cootie Williams, but I didn't know a lot about him. And so I really appreciate the detail that you brought. Can you, for our listeners, can you kind of give us a brief understanding of why it is important for us to know who he was?
Well, one of the things about jazz biography these days is there still are a lot of musicians who need biographical treatment. One of the things about Cootie Williams is a lot of the stuff that is out there about him is just repeats of older stuff, and it may or may not even be accurate. But Cootie had such a career that it's amazing that somebody didn't write it before. You mentioned him playing with Duke Ellington. Well, he started with Duke Ellington in 1929 at the age of 18. You know, that's extremely young. And he became a star soloist with the band. He was a master of the plunger mute. And he also played open styles. He could play ballads. He was very versatile. And his versatility was such that he came to the attention of Benny Goodman. And when Benny Goodman hired him in 1940, one of the things that was very shocking at the time, because black musicians and white musicians just really didn't play together because of the way society is was structured at the time. Maybe I should say is structured now, even the way we're going. But he became a star with his band too, and then he became successful enough with Goodman to do his own band, and eventually it petered out. But he went back to Ellington and recaptured a lot of his old glory.
Kind of a through line really is his skill and his preparation. He's born in Mobile, Alabama. And how did he get from Mobile to Duke Ellington's band at 18?
Well, he was one of those people that loved his instrument and he studied and practiced. One of the things that I still see occasionally is people say, oh, he was self-taught. Well, nothing was further than the truth. He was fortunate enough to be able to take lessons at a young age from one of the brass band leaders there in Mobile, Charlie Lipscomb, and he drilled him relentlessly on the fundamentals of the trumpet. He studied the Arban's book, which is a book that's still used today. So you get all the fundamentals, all the reading skills you need from that book. So when Cootie went to New York in 1928, he was able to read anything that was put in front of him. And in a big band, that's a very important skill. There are some people that have reading skills, there are some people that have soloing skills. Cootie had both, so that made him a very important musician.
So I play trombone. I started playing when I was in sixth grade. I never had private lessons. And so I know I have some bad habits. And as a brass player, and I don't play much anymore, but I really do understand. And we use the Arban's book. And so what I was thinking about as I was reading that information is the essayist Malcolm Gladwell. He talks about the concept of mastery. And he
Yes.
says, if one does something, practices, or something 10,000 hours, they reach a level of mastery. And that's what I see him reaching probably in his teens. Like when I see pictures of him, I've seen pictures of other brass players later in life, and you look at their lips and you can tell they play.
Yes.
And that's because they're pressing to get that pressure, which is a bad habit.
Exactly.
And so he had a long career. And that foundation, to me, helps explain that. This is a comprehensive biography, but can you briefly maybe give us a condensed version of the high points of his jazz career?
Oh, of course, yes.
Part
Well, one
of
of the things I do want to add on your previous point is as an adult professional musician, he continued to take lessons. So he took lessons from some of the best people in New York, like William Costello. So he never thought he knew it all. There was always something to learn. So that's another important trait that he had. Now, to talk about who he played with, there were a few people he played with in Mobile. Then he went to Jacksonville with the Alonzo Ross Deluxe Syncopators. But his career really took off when he went to New York in 1928. He started with Chick Webb for a little bit, and then he was with Fletcher Henderson. Then came the break with Duke Ellington. He replaced Bubber Miley, who was erratic, and he drank too heavily, so he couldn't be depended on. So Cootie was with Duke Ellington from 1929 to 1940. Then came the 1 year contract with Benny Goodman from 1940 to 1941. And then he led his own big band. And this was a important place for him to discover new talent. He had people like Bud Powell, Pearl Bailey, Charlie Parker, Eddie Cleanhead Vincent, Eddie Lockjaw Davis. and others in his band. The big band itself had to be disbanded in 1947. So from 1947 to 1962, he led different combos, and he had a lot of R&B in his band because he also led the house band at the Savoy Ballroom, and part of keeping the audiences happy was to play the music they wanted. So he was a pretty versatile musician in terms of the styles he did too. One of the factors that led to him going back to Ellington is in 1962 was in 1958, the Savoy Ballroom had been struggling, and in 58 it was demolished. And with rock and roll, it was just hard to maintain a jazz career. So in 1962, he went back with Duke Ellington. He stayed with Duke Ellington until Ellington died. Mercer Ellington, Duke Ellington's son, took over the band in 1974 at Duke's death, and he stayed with Mercer off and on until 1980, and that's when he finally retired. He had enough of the road. He was having health problems, and so his last 5 years were in retirement.
Can you talk about your research and the documents? A lot of the images, it says author's collection. Had you begun that before the book, or was it in researching the book and there are interviews that you came across? What were the things that helped you flesh out his life?
Well, as a jazz fan, I guess I should use the full term fanatic because that's what I really am. I have been collecting this music since I was 10 years old. So I have had a bunch of CDs, albums, books that gave me a good basis to start it. And, through the years, I've gotten things from eBay. And starting with the book project, I realized I needed to get some things that were missing, like pictures, to fill out the book. And it's fortunate that a lot of the stuff for someone like Cootie Williams isn't expensive. It's not like you're trying to collect pop star memorabilia where you can pay through the nose for that stuff. But it wasn't that hard for me because I had a lot of stuff already.
And what was the process to find a publisher?
The standard process, first of all, I realized quickly that none of the commercial presses will touch you unless you have an agent. And I quickly found out that that's nearly impossible. So I decided to go the academic route. One of the first ones I contacted was the University of California Press, since I'm an alum of UCLA, but they quickly turned me down. So I just sent out a series of query letters to the academic presses of the different states. And fortunately, Craig Gill of the University Press of Mississippi said yes.
Do you get a sense of why he said yes?
I think looking at their catalog, they're very open to music and it's open to Black culture. And being Mississippi, it's. I had sent one to the University of Alabama since Cootie was from Mobile, but they said no. So the next state over said yes. I really hoped that it would be a southern state just because Cootie's of the South.
And there are times when he is even playing the blues, and he has links with blues singers as well. And Mississippi, at one time they had, I don't know if they still do, they had an annual Mississippi Blues Festival, and blues and jazz are not far apart, even though
No.
our genre categories are kind of artificial, really. And
Yeah.
what do you think is the attraction for somebody who might not be a jazz fan for this book?
I think that you don't necessarily have to be a jazz fan. You can learn a bit about American history. One of the things you learn is that a lot of people don't know that it was taboo for big bands to have mixed personnel. And Cootie's moving to Benny Goodman was literally earth-shaking. One of the things I have in the book is the page from the front page of Metronome magazine, where it's huge print that Cootie Williams went over there like that. It was the black white issue, but it was also the issue that Ellington's band was such that people didn't leave his band. Everybody in his band was there for years and years. So even that part of it was another thing that shook people up. There's also Cootie's involvement in the civil rights issues. He wrote open letters against the DAR, Daughters of the American Revolution, and in support of the Federal Employment Practices Committee. He was very involved politically, and that was something that surprised me because you don't read that anywhere. So there's a lot of Black history, American history, music history I learned, and hopefully others can learn from reading this book.
Can you talk about his personal life? He lived in a few places, even though he's on the road a lot. His base for a lot of his life was in New York, and then it shifts. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. When he was in New York, one of the places he lived was 555 Edgecombe Avenue in Harlem. It's a National Historic Place now, but at the time he was living there, it had people like Canada Lee, the actor, Joe Louis, a few other famous people. I can't recall them all off the top of my head. But at the time he was living there, they were having some maintenance problems with leaks and non-working elevators. And he was pressured by his wife to get a house. She had wanted a house for quite a while. She was tired of a apartment living. So they bought a house in Addisley Park, which is a landmark Black district in Queens. Not too far from him, a good friend of his neighbor was Count Basie. So Cootie Williams and Count Basie were neighbors. There were other famous musicians in the area. Joe Louis also moved there. So he continued his friendship with Joe Louis. Basically, it was kind of the creme de la creme of Black society. They were also recently declared a landmark district. When Cootie decided to downsize after going back to Ellington, he sold his home to James Brown, Godfather of Soul. So it was quite a neighborhood there.
Definitely, definitely. And another thing I want to be sure we talk about is just kind of seeing the really where you started when you were saying you understood the life of jazz musicians and how life on the road, and you made a decision that you didn't really want to do that. But Cootie Williams did. Can you talk a little bit about what a typical day might have been like for him on the road? And the challenges, particularly in terms of lodging as they traveled in the South.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest problems for Cootie Williams. And musicians in general had a hard life on the road because in those days there was no interstate freeway system and roads were in different shapes. And a lot of times you might have to make really big jumps between cities because you were going from one job to the next. And you may not even get time to sleep or eat in between. Well, that's musicians in general, but Black musicians had an additional problem where they could not stay in most of the hotels, north or south, and they did not always know where they could eat. In the South, they had to usually rely on a network of families. There was a lot of Black families that would take in these musicians and they'd stay with them. One of the things that was advantageous about Cootie staying with Benny Goodman was that essentially Benny Goodman was the 800-pound gorilla. Benny Goodman could enforce things that other people didn't.
Because of what?
Benny Goodman didn't really care about what race you were. He wanted the best band possible. So if people didn't want Cootie on the stand, Benny Goodman would say, "Well, you don't get any of the band then," and he'd either leave the gig or never book it to begin with.
And
He
his
was
power came from
his popularity.
yeah.
And others could have done so if they'd been willing to take a stand, but Benny Goodman knew that he was big enough of a draw and important enough of a musician where he had this clout and he was willing to use it. He wasn't the only one. There were people like Artie Shaw, Gene Krupa, and the like, Charlie Barnett, that were also staunch allies, and they also tried to integrate their bands. But it was hard. It was an additional impediment to life on the road. It was very rough. And someone like Roy Eldridge, he was a trumpeter with Artie Shaw and Gene Krupa. It kind of broke him. He did not have the strength that Cootie had. And maybe it was because was from Pittsburgh as opposed to the Deep South. So it was all a little bit new to him.
I mean, what's striking throughout the book when you mention different musicians for the first time, most of the time you include their birth and death dates, and a lot of them die quite young. And there's different reasons for that, but it's another way of conveying how hard the life on the road was in that profession.
Yeah, when you think about it, of course, they didn't know about the dangers of secondhand smoke in those days, but a lot of them were smokers themselves. So secondhand smoke was only part of it. You're on the road, you're sedentary. A lot of them, to relieve stress, drank or indulged in other vices. So that shortens your lifespan. You're not exercising, you're not eating well. There's a lot of things that contribute to them not living very long.
Can you talk about why there wasn't a book before now? It's great that we have one now, but he died in 1985.
Yeah, I wish someone had done it before because there were more people around that had firsthand experience with him. There were some people that I wish I could have spoken with, and some I barely missed, and some of the older people that were still around had dementia or Alzheimer's, so they weren't available to talk, even though they were physically here. I think there's a general problem with jazz biographies. Well, I don't know how much they sell. I don't think that should be criteria. I think it should be about scholarship. But I don't know why there aren't more biographies of people who should have one. For example, one of the people I think should have a biography is Mercer Ellington. He's Duke Ellington's son. He's a composer and arranger, band leader, and no one's written about him. There is a tendency to do the same people over and over, and I don't think that's something unique to jazz. There's how many Lincoln biographies out there?
And more to come.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have a project that you're working on?
Yes, my next project, as a matter of fact, is about another trumpeter, oddly enough. His name is Lester Bowie. He's no relation to me, but he died in 1999, and no one's done a biography of him. One of the neat ones that just recently came out was Henry Threadgill, saxophonist, and he was fortunately around to write his book in collaboration with the name escapes me. But and then there was another one about Sonny Simmons that I'm almost done reading. So there's a lot of ground out there that hasn't been taken up yet.
How is Cootie Williams viewed by the jazz world now? And is his music still being played? And he composed some.
Yes, he composed some, a lot with Ellington. And as he got older, it became less and less of a priority. You'll see that his output tailed off. One of the things that he's most popular for is a Thelonious Monk song, Round Midnight. Well, I go into how his name got on that. He did compose a part of it, but because of the dynamics between them, age and professional status, it's kind of viewed controversially that his name is on that composition.
Yeah, I appreciate it. There's a quote you have from Billy Strayhorn, where Billy Strayhorn is kind of speaking to the controversy about joint authorship of compositions. And
Yeah, I thought that was pretty apropos, and especially coming from someone like him, he's involved in a lot of the evaluation of Ellington and the Ellington-Strayhorn relationship. And unfortunately, a lot of people think they have to put down Ellington to rise up Strayhorn, but you don't have to. They were both great, and they, yeah, there needs to be a reevaluation, but Ellington was great before Strayhorn, and he was great after Strayhorn.
well, with this book, are there other things you want to be sure listeners know about the book or about Cootie Williams?
Well, one of the things they need to know, very importantly, is the music. Listen to the music. So I was fortunate enough to get a four CD set made by a British company called Acrobat, and it's also entitled Concerto for Cootie. They have a different public domain system over there, so they were able to put together these recordings prior to 1962, and I selected the tracks and I wrote the notes. So that is probably one of the most important things to know. And you will hear by listening to the music, he was great with the open trumpet. He was great with the plunger mute. He could play ballads. He could play blues. Very talented and very versatile. And he won polls over Louis Armstrong and Roy Eldridge and the like. So he was the real deal. But that kind of gets lost over time. And one of the things I'd like to shout out is the Black Press, because a lot of these details in the book would not have been possible without them. Our press wrote about things that were ignored by the mainstream press. So it would be a lot poorer book without that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That was author Stephen Bowie talking with bio member and fellow biographer Kevin Magruder about his biography, Concerto for Cootie, The Life and Times of Cootie Williams. It was published by the University of Mississippi Press in October 2025, and this interview was recorded via Zoom in May of this year. To learn more about bio, or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillinganes created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer. And Shereen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.